I don't know kind of where to begin with this interview tonight, except to tell you that Lincoln Starnes, the author of American Phoenix, which tells stories and pulls recollections from the rubble of the attack on the Pentagon on 9/11, is not a professional writer, except as far as I can tell, this book. Maybe it's that perspective that has allowed him to see freshly what other story crafters have ignored or couldn't capture. It's a beautiful book. It's really interesting, minute by minute, of what happened leading up to and then during and after the American Airlines jet that slammed into the side of the Pentagon at 9:37, and I believe 36 seconds, 9:37:36, on 9/11. And you're going to hear some of those stories of heroism, but also hopefully understand better a month out-ish before 9/11 just how significant this work really is, and what he's added, I think, to our understanding of both our humanity in the face of crisis and what really happened that day. We'll get to that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Lincoln Starnes, am I pronouncing that correctly? There is no emphasis on the last three letters, is there?
No, sir, just Starnes.
Okay. Just want to make sure it wasn't Starnes or something like
No.
that. Are you still a full-time courier for FedEx?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And this is your first book.
No, sir. I wrote a book about my father,
Okay.
around the same time I wrote this.
All
And
right.
so it's two books. My brother has more things published than I do. He's really the author.
Not anymore. American Phoenix is the name of the book. It's just you did a great job. You should be very proud of this book.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
What got you started talking to and trying to figure out minute by minute what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11?
Well, it's partly based on my brother's recollections. And the book is actually 18 years old. It was written back in 2003. And I tried to get it published, but I didn't have any luck, so I shelved it. And then he just kept bugging me over the years to publish it. And he finally came to me. He told me he would put the money behind it to have it self-published. And so I said, okay, I'll help you, any way I can. And so he's really the prime mover. But the impetus for the book came from him originally anyway.
How did you get access, Lincoln, to the people that you interview and the stories that you tell, the way that you keep pivoting as you go in minute by minute up to the impact and then the aftermath?
I can't tell you how I did that. If I were to start out to write this book today, I wouldn't write it. Because I don't know, I was possessed of something, I guess, to write it at the time. But like I said, it came from my brother, and I initially started with two of his himself and two of his colleagues. See, he was an Army surgeon at Walter Reed, stationed at Walter Reed on the day of 9/11. And he was dispatched by his superior, James Goff, who was the his superior, Maniscalco, had been evacuated to Site R in the mountains of northern Maryland. And that left Goff in charge of the DOD response to the attack. And he couldn't think of anybody that he could send over there. And he remembered that Ben, my brother, had done a tour in Kosovo and had also patched up gangbangers during the crack wars in D.C. During the 1990s. So he'd been in the blood. And so he knew that if he sent Ben over there, Ben would be able to organize things and and that he could, you know, he could count on him. So he sent Ben over to the area outside the West Wall in the parking lot, and then he sent Ed Lucci, who's another one of my brother's colleagues, to the interior of the Pentagon. And so basically what I did was I took all of their accounts and I recorded them, and then I tried to make a book out of it, but there wasn't enough material. So then I just started cold calling people. So the book is actually, it's based on his accounts and the accounts of his colleagues, and then also on all the news articles that I could get my hands on, all of the reference texts on the Pentagon, the history of the Pentagon, and then also on about a series of about 17 interviews that I did. And I had to get permission from the military to interview some of the people because they were still in the military. Yeah. And everybody in the armed services was very gracious and helpful. But some of the people I just couldn't get in touch with. They either didn't want to be interviewed at the time, or I just couldn't gain access to them.
Who was the last person you interviewed? What year?
The very last person I interviewed? Mm-hmm. I don't remember that right now.
What year?
I interviewed quite a few people, and it was over the course of about 6 months. I know that I've been somewhere, somebody said that I spent decades. I didn't spend decades. The book took about a year and a half to write, and I did about those 17 interviews over the course of about 6 to 8 months. And then I basically recorded it all, and then I began the writing. But I didn't have any idea how I was gonna set it up so that I could follow all these characters through the book. But I did. And then when we went to publish it, and the publisher came back, and they had fact checkers, and they had people do revisions. I did revisions, and this took about a year, a little bit more than a year, to get that done.
Okay. The reason why I ask is, when you said you shelved it, I'm curious on the year that you last did an interview before you closed the book and said, well, there it is. And what year was that when it was?
It's interesting that the writing of these books, the writing of the book on my father and who was a master cabinet maker. And so I wrote a book it's a picture book, basically, that documented he was a maker of 18th century period furniture. And so I did that book, and I did this book around the same time. And we also lost my father during the year of 9/11. It was always eerie to me how that happened, because he contracted cancer in early 2001, and he was beating it. And right before 9/11, he was scheduled for surgery, and they thought they'd gotten it all with chemotherapy and drugs and everything. And they had scheduled him for surgery at Sloan Kettering Memorial Hospital in downtown Manhattan on 9/11. So when the attack happened, it delayed his surgery for about 2 weeks. And when he came out of it, we had a big party for him because they thought he had beaten it. And within 2 months, he was dead. So it was almost like the attacks, to me, were almost like a bad omen that my father wasn't going to make it. And so all that was happening. And then I began writing the books. And I got the first one published on his, you know, on his furniture. And then when I went to publish American Phoenix, I had it under the name Pentagon 9/11. And I basically took that, and I took it to several publishers. I couldn't get it published. And, of course, I was doing this while I was holding down a full-time job. Yeah. And I just basically shelved it, and I forgot about it.
What
and,
year?
I said that, you know.
What year?
You know, I forgot about it. And my brother just kept bugging me to do it.
Yeah.
So
I totally get that.
To do it, really.
Okay, well, I'll give up on that, but I'm curious, and I will remain so on that, because there's something so fresh and raw, and what I love about, I mean, I'm not making a comment about 18th century furniture, you avoid a veneer on this writing and in the book. You avoid a kind of polish It's not to say that the book is, rough or, in some way unreadable, or it's the exactly the opposite. But what makes it so interesting to me is it sounds like something that you were there experiencing. Like you had this sort of like you were almost like some sort of drone, and you were going in between all of these areas because that's how it reads. And as you say, you create these timelines for these people that and what they experienced on a minute by minute basis, and that's extraordinary. And I thought I was kind of curious, like, how come this book didn't get published earlier? And then I was thinking, well, maybe you were still working
I
to up on
appreciate
it
that.
until the
I
last
wrote it
minute.
like a movie. I essentially wrote it like a movie, as if I was making it into a movie. So that's how I approached it.
So again, we're talking with Lincoln Starnes. The book is American Phoenix, and it's about the heroes of 9/11 at the Pentagon. Lincoln, how do you process, or how did, for that matter, how did your brother process the number of people who said this wasn't a plane, it was a missile, this was all something that the Pentagon did to itself, false flag operation, any other tropes like that?
To tell you the truth, I haven't heard much about that. I haven't heard.
Good.
I've heard people say that that this was intentional, that people within our own government did it, but not too much. Not too much of that. I mean, it happened. It was terrorists that flew the plane into the thing. When they went in and they found the wreckage, they found their remains in the cockpit. So there's no doubt that this happened. And I mean, it was thoroughly researched. We went to the Pentagon. We stood up on a hill, and my brother and I looked down at it. And of course, we couldn't go inside, but we just looked at it, and we looked at the graves in Arlington Cemetery. We saw where the flight path of the plane was, And just by, I guess, going over it over and over and over and over again, I guess I developed a sense for
Now
it.
you
But
did.
I've always had a flair for the dramatic, so. I guess I put that in there. I guess I did a pretty good job with it.
Yeah, you did. So, Lincoln, you had a chance to capture some things which I had never heard before. What do you think of when, in the stories that you tell in American Phoenix, what do you think of as being the most unique perspective? Or the one which got the least attention, if it had gotten any attention before, that you've been able to offer in the book.
A unique perspective. I guess it was tying the actions of all the characters together as if they were one big family, responding to an attack. And that's really what the military is like. They're like a big family. And as far as heroes are concerned, I mean that's something that just happens. You never know how you're going to respond when something like that happens, and it's very sudden and very terrifying. And I think a hero basically, I think a lot of people just think, how am I going to get out of this? And a hero thinks, how am I going to get everybody out of this? I think that's as simple as that.
I'll tell you how it hit me. So I'm reading the story, and I kept going forward. I would read like a couple of pages, and then I just had to keep going to that hour and minute 9:37, and I would sort of fast forward because I would become invested in some of these people. And that impact minute, I mean, the way that you tell that of all the different things that were happening at that moment, and that as they begin to tell their story, some of the things that stick out to me are like the person that was close enough to the jet, to the American Airlines jet, that they could, at least as if I got it right, they could make out faces in the windows as the jet, which was going obviously hundreds of miles an hour, as the jet went into the Pentagon, but they could see faces. And I read that part, and it caught me so off guard because I thought that would be the thing I would see every night in my dreams, is that face and not being able to stop that plane from hitting that wall.
Well, especially children.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you were standing out on the tarmac at an airfield, at an airport, and you were standing close enough to the plane, which of course they wouldn't let you do, and that thing was coming in for a landing, it's moving at high speed, and if you were that close, you could see the faces in the windows, especially on a real bright day like it was. It was a beautiful, clear day. You know, I just remember that, and you know, so and the sun was shining, and it, just the setting for it was so unlike anything. Like, I think I referred to it in the book as an axe murderer walking into a home at breakfast.
Yeah.
And just wiping the family out. I mean, you know, have a beautiful day, everybody's sitting at breakfast eating, and somebody comes in and kills everybody. I mean, that's really what it was. I mean, you would think that the setting would be different for something terrible like that. It was almost as if it was a setup, you know, and I think that people were in shock when they saw that plane. They knew what it was, but they were just in total shock, like Alan Wallace and some of the fellows that were close enough to the construction area.
Yeah.
You know, when they saw that thing come in.
Like, is Alan Wallace, pardon me, because I do most of the show in the dark, so I've got the book closed and I'm sitting in darkness. So was it Alan who was standing there thinking this is going to be his last moment as the plane cleared his head by about 5 feet?
No, that was his name escapes me now.
That's all right. Me too.
He was a contractor.
Yeah.
And he
had the presence of mind. It was like, it was almost like his life was flashing before his eyes as he saw this jet coming, and it cleared his head.
Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, he was walking to his pickup truck, and that thing came flying in and went right. I mean, basically, just almost gave him a close ankle shave.
Yeah.
And it came right in and it caught that generator, and ripped it out of its mount and carried the fence with it. One of the biggest problems they had was they had construction going on and they had these propane canisters. Those caused a lot of problems because they just started exploding and flying everywhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, that must have, I mean, the way I saw it is that when it happened, it must have happened so quickly that the way they see it is very slowed down. You know how when something traumatic happens and you remember, you don't remember at high speed, you remember it in slow motion.
Right.
And so I imagine that's what I tried to convey. I tried to convey the slow motion to slow everything down, even though that happened just like that, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a video online of the plane actually hitting the west wall and this huge orange fireball coming out of it. And he can still be found. And it's actually from the perspective of the firehouse where Alan Wallace was standing.
We're talking with Lincoln Starnes. He's going to be our guest tonight. There will be questions coming up later on that I know will engage you, and I look forward to hearing how people will try to understand better what happened that day. We're a month away from the 9/11 celebrations or so, but what we, and I say celebrations meaning the honoring of the fallen and also the fact that we were able to overcome this horror, this tragedy, and rebuild. And that's very much part of the story of American Phoenix. But Lincoln, I'm there was one thing that you wrote in the prologue that I want to get to coming up in just a second. And I thought it was such an interesting frame for what happened on September 11th, that I, especially with the number of stories that I had read about the Pentagon, I'd never read that one. And that's part of what is the magic of this book. It's such a sincere and authentic reflection. Heroes of the Pentagon on 9/11, American Phoenix. You'll hear more about those heroes coming up, stories you've never heard before. If you've got Coast Insider, by the way, you can go back and listen to last night's show. We were talking about superheroes, and we're talking about the people who are the real-life superheroes who patrol the streets in various cities and fighting crime. It's always fun to have Coast Insider at your disposal. Find out more at coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Punnett. There are so many moments of heroism, of people reaching out, trying to help somebody. Lincoln Starnes was just talking about that before the bottom of the hour break, and he was expressing that it was like a family, that the military came together and heroes did what heroes do. And you'll hear about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Lincoln Starnes is a full-time courier for FedEx and a two-time author. First one was about his dad's woodworking. But second one here is what I think is a worthy addition to our national consciousness about what happened on 9/11, especially with regard to the Pentagon. And, you know, it's remarkable that as Lincoln was telling the story, the book was finished and then it sat for a very long time before it ended back up on the shelves now here coming up on the 20th anniversary. You were an English major in college. Was that right, Lincoln?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I went to the University of Virginia. Yeah.
Go Cavaliers? Is that what y'all are? Is that
the... Yeah, Wahoo.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm so excited about football season. I'm stupid about football. So I'm, like, really geeked out about that. But I'm reminded, did you ever read Coleridge's Kubla Khan, the epic poem?
No, but I know about the Mongols. I mean, I'm familiar with the Mongols and the Khans, but I never read that. No.
The writing of Coleridge wrote Rhyme and the Ancient Mariner, and he was part of that romantic period of long-form epic poetry. And the story of Kubla Khan is that he wrote it out of an opium-induced dream, and he was working on it, and he had all of those wonderful words and phrases that he came up to describe that story were in his mind, and he's jotting them down furiously while they're still fresh in his brain, and he gets interrupted by somebody pounding on his door, and the rest of the poem is lost for eternity. And so the poem Kubla Khan goes unfinished. He shares it with his friends like Wordsworth and Byron and whatever, but he never publishes it until like 20 years later when the poem is finally published in an unfinished form, but it sat there forever. And I think that's, I just
so
couldn't
Coleridge
help but think.
Coleridge was a contemporary of Byron.
Yeah, he was part of the Romantic period. Yeah, American. Right. And I think that British, but I mean, that period was so profound in American literature too, and so influential. But I just mean that he was such an interesting character, and that idea of something sitting that was essentially needed to be published, and it was just sort of gestating, like this book is. That's the only reason I drew that parallel. I just thought that's what this, because there's something
written before its time has come.
Yeah, exactly. Good way to look at it. So the book American Phoenix, it talks about the heroes of the Pentagon in 9/11. You talk about in the prologue about the building of the Pentagon and the vision that Roosevelt bought into for a building which was going to put everybody, all of the military branches under the same roof. Talk about that.
Well, Roosevelt, yeah, they had several, buildings within D.C. that held all the different agencies of the military, and it was a very awkward situation. They couldn't communicate very well, especially back during those days in the 30s, the Depression era. So he needed one building so that he could consolidate the Army, Navy, the Air Corps at the time, into one building. So he basically came up with the idea of I don't know if he came up with the idea, I forget now, of the five sides, the chevron shape, the pentagram to put down there. I'm not sure if it was him or Somerville or one of the other people.
I think it was Somerville, but I think regardless, there were factions within his own administration who did and didn't want to put everybody together in one basket.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, because, well, it's the government, you know, and everybody has their own interests.
But there was also a fear that you were creating this target. Like, if you put everybody together, it's one bomb away from, right? And still is.
That's what it is. It's a giant target. And it's right next to the Potomac River. It's almost foolhardy, but they did. And to put it where they put it, which is in a swamp. See, that whole area where that was put is the ancient, ancestral home of the Lee family, Robert E. Lee. And the actual mansion that sits above the Kennedy grave is the Lee Mansion. That's where their family lived. That was their ancestral land. And that down there was the bottoms. It was a floodplain.
Yeah.
Basically dropping it right there in a floodplain. Yeah, and it's a big pentagram, so it's, I mean, it's a big, not a pentagram, but a five-sided.
It's a pentagon. Yeah, it's pentagon, right. It's pentagonal. Right. But the building and the date that it was consecrated, the day they did the first shovel for the Pentagon was what?
September 11th, 1941.
Never knew that.
Yeah.
And
it's
60...
True. As a matter of fact, I mean, when we were writing it, I think someone wanted me to take that out, or they left it out. One of the proofreaders left that out, and I said, you can't leave that out. I said, that's a synchronicity.
Yeah, why did they want to take it out?
I don't know. I mean, they wanted me to take out the whole first paragraph. I wouldn't let them do it.
Why?
A proofreader is not seeing what the author's saying.
No.
They're basically hired to proofread the work.
Yeah.
And they do a good job. They
sure.
do their job. But when they start making suggestions as to the structure of it and the creative aspect of it, that's when you need to tell them to take a seat.
Well, but here's what it does as an author. Maybe you'll agree or not. It makes you have to defend it. It makes you realize,
right?
You either have to come up with a pretty good argument to keep it or shut up yourself.
Yeah, it makes you reflect on it, whether or not you really want to keep it.
But that idea that they wanted to take out the fact that the first shovel that was sunk in the ground to commemorate the beginning of the building of the Pentagon was September 11th, 1941, just months away from Pearl Harbor, and of course, 60 years to the day before. I'd like even to know what hour that shovel went into the ground.
So would I. I think that is a remarkable historical synchronicity, which indicates that there is a, it's proof that there's something else guiding things. It's not the actions of men. It's a higher power. It's God.
It sure seems like that. You know, especially because it's 60 years and yet at the same time, the critics of that decision were wrong. Right? Because the building still stood. Somebody took a shot at it, and because of the story you tell in American Phoenix, the Pentagon absorbed that shot, as tragic as it was, and came back stronger as a result of it.
It's the American people.
I agree with that.
It's the American people.
Their
and that's
spirit.
What they, whoever, whatever enemies oppose us, better understand that it's the American people that they're fighting. It's not our government. It's not a president or a congressman or a senator. It's the people. And they've always lost. There's been a lot of people tried to take this country down, and they failed at it. And that's just another example. You know, did we collapse after Pearl Harbor? No. And we lost more people in this attack than we did at Pearl Harbor. I think it was 2,500 at Pearl Harbor. And this was over 3,000.
Yeah. On 9/11. Yeah.
Right.
So you got a creaky chair, by the way.
Yeah.
I hope it's an old wood chair, like an old wood office chair.
It's about to fall apart.
Okay.
But I'm just trying to hear you real well because I don't have my speakerphone on. And
good.
They told me to cut that off. So
yeah, good. You don't want to do that. The trade-off is worth it. Trust me, because you sound fine.
Yeah.
All right. So there are so many stories. So let's just start there. When you start to read American Phoenix, you'll immediately get a sense for how everything will converge at that moment at 9:37:36 when the impact takes place on that wall at the Pentagon. But after it happens, as you began to investigate this, you know, not quite 20 years ago, as you began to collect these stories, tell me about some of the heroes that you were inspired by as you wrote down their oral histories.
Well, I think that, you know, I don't want to slight anybody. There were heroes that I never spoke to, that never got their story told, and they're out there, and maybe they're listening to this program. And I don't, you know, I don't mean to slight them, but these are essentially the people that that I included in the book. Well, I first learned about through the articles, but I would say it was Staff Sergeant Christopher Brayman. He's probably stands out as one of the foremost heroes. Craig Powell, the Navy SEAL that held up a section of ceiling to allow people to crawl between his legs. And he had had a very heavy woman had jumped out of a second story window or second story, the second level onto his leg and landed on his leg. So he was in extreme pain. And to me, he's a legend. They ought to have a module down at the UDT SEAL Museum in Fort Pierce. And Bob Reeve down there is the one that got me in touch with Craig Powell. But they ought to have, he's a genuine American legend because of what he did, because he earned the moniker Big John after that minor.
Yeah, sure, in the song Big Bad John.
Big Bad John or Big John.
Yeah.
And Tony Rose, who was another one of the major heroes to me, gave him that name. And Tony he's from the swamps up in North Carolina, up around Gum Neck, North Carolina. And he worked a lot. He worked with Craig Powell to save people. But I would say Brayman, one of the reasons it makes Brayman stand out is that Brayman did not leave the Pentagon for almost 5 days and was still in the same clothes, covered with blood and human matter until somebody told him to go on home. And he stood down. And also, there was Ted Anderson, Colonel Ted Anderson, Lieutenant Colonel, I think, at the time, Ted Anderson. And he and Brayman had a standoff with the D.C. firefighters who didn't want to let them back in the building. And there was a tense standoff between the two. And they actually broke through the line of the firefighters and crawled back inside. And I think there was a scuffle to try to keep them from going inside there because the firefighters had to do their job. And these heroes wanted to get back in and save lives. And so you had a standoff. But I would say Chris Brayman, Craig Powell, Sergeant Major Tony Rose, Ted Anderson, Marilyn Willis stands out because she kept her head when the attack happened, and she saved a lot of lives just by keeping her head, just by keeping her cool and staying under the smoke and leading people out. And a lot of this was done in the darkness and in the smoke. I mean, people just, one of the chapters is called A Voice in the Darkness. And the proofreaders wanted me to name it Voices in the Darkness, but I said, no, it's A Voice in the Darkness because you have to see it from the perspective of one person, even though it's a lot of people.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because that voice was guiding them. They didn't know where that voice was coming from, but it was one person, really. And in a lot of cases, that was Marilyn Willis or Roxanne Cruz Cortez, who was a tough Puerto Rican from New York City. And she essentially was kind of like the same as Marilyn. So these are the heroes that stand out to me and the ones that I focused on in there. But I'm sure there were others that were just as heroic.
Maybe
I just never was able to, get all the stories. I don't think that would be possible. In my time frame.
Well, maybe in an expanded edition coming up when there's a 10th anniversary of this book, you'll have a chance to sit down with some of the other people. But I want to talk more about Marilyn. What was Marilyn's job at the Pentagon?
You know, it escapes me. She worked in the Army Command Center. I think she was in the Army Personnel Center.
But a civilian.
Another another person would be Phil McNair, who's her boss, I believe. And they all work in the personnel center of the Army. Basically, the attack happened on the west wall where the Army command center was. The Navy command center was below it, and the Army personnel center was upstairs. It was all in there. It was Army and Navy. And I believe she was on the, I think she was on the second floor. And one of the biggest problems for them was that once the plane had cut through the building and plunged everything into darkness, basically everything was plunged into darkness was because they had to cut the power, because you had all these power lines that posed a danger with all the fuel around and everything. So sure. Someone had to go in and cut that power. And it goes into that. It describes how that was done. And then they were all plunged into darkness. And so essentially they formed daisy chains, where they got down on the ground and they started crawling. And one person at the head of the daisy chain would head for a door. And then if that door was blocked, they would head, to another door. And they were taking shirts, pieces of clothing, and soaking it in water that was, being sprayed down from the sprinklers in the ceiling. And they would suck on that, because of the smoke. And that helped them, cope with it, to get through there. But a lot of them they just curled up and they wouldn't move forward. And Maryland's friend Regina Grant, and I believe Regina Grant passed away, but Marilyn helped Regina out, and Regina wanted to give up several times, and Marilyn, kept egging her on. And that to me is a hero, because these people just wanted to curl up and die. They just wanted to give up, and these people just wouldn't lie down.
And they wouldn't let them. And the story of Marilyn or any of these heroes, American Phoenix, brings it all together for that big minute. That story about the firefighters is so interesting, because, as you say, the firefighters were just doing their job. They're trying to create how they're told to create a safety perimeter.
Right.
And that they think in terms of one aspect of the big picture is to keep people from going back into a burning building, because, the percentage-wise, that doesn't usually play out. That if they're not the ones going in with the experience and with the equipment to retrieve somebody, right, to exfil them out back onto out of the smoke and out of the fire. If the firefighters aren't doing it, then nobody else should be doing it. But that's okay. I mean, they're not there to decide, oh, this person looks like they can go inside. Oh, better not be you. Maybe this person can be. They're there to stop everybody.
Right. They were doing their job. It was a classic standoff, because in the military, you don't leave anybody behind.
Right.
You don't ever do that. And that's what Colonel Ted Anderson talked about. He's like, we don't leave people behind. There are people in there. We've got to go in and get them. And the firefighter said, no, you're not going back in there. And so, there was just a standoff there. They didn't want to, neither side wanted to yield, and both sides were right, I'd have to say.
Right. No, that's totally fair. It's interesting, because, of course, we think of the firefighters and the sacrifices they made in the towers going up to get people and help them come down. And in this case, it was a different paradigm. Same training, said can't let these people in, but they went in anyway, because they were also working on kind of a different criteria, as you say. That's part of the military ethos of never leaving a buddy behind. So to go back in and bring them all out, to bring out as many people as they could, these are some of the heroes you'll read about in American Phoenix. Coming up in the next hour, we'll give you the numbers. Not right away. I'm going to take Lincoln Starnes for another half hour before we give you the numbers, so that you can join the conversation about that. The heroes you don't know about, that you should know about, in this book on 9/11 at the Pentagon on Coast to Coast AM This is Ian Punnett.